Good evening. Welcome to the weekly Money and Market Report. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm delighted you could join me this week. Today is Thursday, February 4th, 2021. On the website, this week I was going to do how to use the Solaria report, and then we decided we were going to simplify the homepage. So I'll do it next week. We wanted to make sure that we could make access easier and more simple. So I'll record that and get your questions in if you have questions about how to use the website or any aspect of the Solaria report. Wrap-ups, the great mystery is the great big post office mystery. On December 14th to 19th, we mailed a significant number of second quarter injection fraud to the United States. It's now over 50 days later, and not one has arrived. Now, that's quite miraculous. We've done a new printing, and we're mailing out from the U.S. last week and this week. So if you're a Digital Plus Print subscriber, you will ultimately get two unless the first batch disappeared completely. Now, it's quite extraordinary because they were individually wrapped to be mailed. Anyway, but if you ultimately get two or three, depending on who you are, please feel free to keep the extras and circulate as you choose. We've seen several situations where we've sent orders in the U.S. where the tracking shows they were delivered, but the subscribers say that they have not been. I assure you, we are responsible to get these to you. And so if the post office says you have it, but you don't have it, we're going to send you another one, but we need to run it down. Anyway, we're getting reports from others as well as other situations we're dealing with where we're seeing international or U.S. mail take anywhere from 3 to 8 weeks. So please, if you have not received an order other than the U.S., you're waiting for your injection fraud, another copy is coming through, please let us know. We're going to always just keep sending until you get it. You get what you've paid for, but I'm beginning to wonder if we're going to have to start Pony Express again. Third quarter Visions of Freedom will go to the third quarter 2020 wrap-up will go to the printer shortly. And right after that, the 2020 annual wrap-up is almost done, and it will go to the printer thereafter. So they're going to keep flying out to you. Events, our customer service is getting lots of calls, and we continue to organize training with hosts and encouraging people to get together. So if you're interested in being a host and helping to gather people in your area, just let customerservice@solaria.com know. I did several shows in January. One was Whitney Webb Podcast and James Corbett. You can find them in the events section. We've now moved that under About Us in the navigation bar. In February, I'm going to do True Pundit's Tom Paine podcast, and then an interview with David Betpatrick, and one on Power Hour, and then a couple more throughout the month. Anyway, a big thank you to everybody who's helped arrange some of these interviews. I'm getting lots of invitations I haven't been able to respond to, but I want you to know if you've sent one, I will respond. It's just a matter of phasing them. We can't do too many in one month. It's more important to do the Solaria report. Take action. The crowdfund continues. We're going to focus on the first quarter to Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. If you haven't joined the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, I really encourage you to do. If you come into the homepage, go to the Take Action crowdfund, just link over, and it'll take you right there. Obviously, you can find it on a search, but we really encourage you to come become a member. We really encourage you to support them. They've got a fundraising push on in the first quarter, and they're defending a lot of people. We have our interview tonight is with John Moody, who's doing Rogue Food, and one of the things he does in the little movie is he tells the story of the regulators trying to stop the local fresh food markets from taking off. We're getting tremendous numbers of questions in subscriber input and Ask Catherine and calls to customer service about what can I do. And there's so much you can do. There's a ton you can do. I decided to republish several pieces that I wrote long ago on the subject of what can I do. And there, if you look at the top of the website, one is rethinking diversification. The other is how to find a good local bank. But in the bottom of them, I've put lots more links, including to a wonderful piece called Coming Clean, another called Building Real Wealth that I did with Franklin Sanders long ago. I just noticed a quote that came in on an email tonight while I was preparing Money in Markets. Let me just read it. It's from somebody named Michael Saylor. There's a macroeconomic wind blowing big. It's going to impact $400 trillion of capital. That capital is sitting in fiat instruments that are being debased. That capital is going to want to convert into strong money. That means real assets. So, of course, my biggest concern is that there's we're staring down a fairly inflationary scenario when it comes to real assets. Now, we may be staring down deflation when it comes to income. So this is a very tricky environment. And I said last week on Jeff Gundlach in his sort of annual look at the market said we need to be prepared for both deflationary and inflationary scenarios. So let's talk a minute about take action. We're going to keep publishing things about the actions you can take between now and the first quarter wrap up, which is going to be called Take Action, Take Two. And so I want to talk about sort of many different actions you can take, but let me focus on a few this week. The first thing is I love to do a time budget because this is all about your time. And if you look at what's going on in the environment, there's more pressure on your time with what I call shadow work. I encouraged you last week to go also find my piece called Shadow Work. You can pick it up on a search. So there's going to be pressure, more and more pressure on your time. Change, you know, change makes things complicated and it eats up time. But do a time budget and look for what are the things in your life that are wasting your time or draining your energy that you can delete. So you need to just start deleting. You know, it's almost like a sailboat that's got to throw over some weight overboard. So look at whatever is draining your time. And the number one thing I would look for is people or institutions that do not have integrity. Get them out of your life. And you need to understand they're risky. It's risky to have institutions or people in your life who have access to knowledge and information who you can't trust, who are low integrity. Get them out. One way to do that is to start with your bank. Find a good local bank who you can trust. There's a piece, so I republished this week, How to Find a Good Local Bank, and it's a process. You know, I've had several people say to me, well, just tell me where to go. And that's not it. It's really important that you take responsibility to understand what you need and to go find it. Because you need to know when it comes to any institution you business with or any institution or investment that you go into. So a bank deposit or a CD is a kind of, I mean, technically it's not a securities, but it's a savings. Although some brokered CDs can, as a regulatory matter, be treated as a security. But any place you put your money, it's important you take responsibility to understand why you're there. One thing I encourage people to do, we'll talk more about it in the future, is get together, do a circle. Do a circle of people who'd also like to change their bank. So if you have neighbors or friends who are interested, you form a little circle and your goal is to help each other basically come clean. There's another piece that's linked from How to Find a Good Local Bank and Rethinking Diversification called Coming Clean. And coming clean is just basically getting the corrupt people and corrupt institutions and corrupt habits out of your life. And it's a process which is a journey. And in my experience, it's never over. There are always more opportunities to come clean, particularly in a world where the corruption is growing. So finding and having a good local bank is one of the important institutions in your life and in your financial life. And if you're putting your money in a bank that's using that money to go engage in criminal activities, then you're facilitating what's going on in this world. If instead you shift your money out of the criminals, you know, the banks that are operating on a really in a criminal model, and you put your money with good, local, hardworking, productive bankers who circulate that money on Main Street, then you're creating a very different kind of world. So to me, do a time budget, find what you can delete that's wasting your time or draining your energy, and then take that time and go through the process of finding a good local bank. And if there are other people who will do that process or form a circle with you, it's a great, I'll tell you, if you say, look, I've got five people who want to come talk to you about opening an account at your bank, you know, you can get a presentation, some attention, and have a very interesting time. I also wanted to mention a book review I published this week called Irreversible Damage. It's about the new phenomena of essentially teenagers, children, wanting to engage in literally surgery or irreversible pharmacology to change themselves, change their sex and do transgender, but do it at an age where where you're making decisions at a very young age to do surgery and bring about surgical change in a way that's irreversible. It's pretty scary. And I'll let the book review speak for itself, but if you're raising a child, particularly a girl, you need to understand that there are real predatory things going on in the educational system and on the internet. And you need to make sure you protect your kids from this before, you know, it literally gets them entrained. And the next thing you know, they want to do irreversible damages to their body. Our theme tonight is on the going direct reset and central bank takeover of the treasury function and fiscal policy with John Titus, and let's cut to it now. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. This is Money in Markets. I'm joined this week by John Titus. If you have not seen Going Direct Reset, John's presentation for the 2020 wrap-up, which we published last week, we're going to talk about it today, and it's, to me, it's the biggest news of the year. It's the biggest news of last year. And John, I just have to tell you again, what a great job you did. It was really, it's not that I didn't know that the going direct reset was what was driving the train, but looking at all the evidence you laid out, it was really breathtaking.
Well, thank you, Catherine. Yeah, it is. Once you dig into the details and look at the timeline, it's very clear what's happened.
Well, it was funny because, you know, you knew, I mean, if you look at the videos you do at Best Evidence, you've been tracking this all along. But it was funny because it had the same impact on you by going deep. You know, it makes you realize it in a much more concrete way.
Well, what I didn't really know and didn't appreciate the significance of was the BlackRock going direct report from, or a policy proposal from August of 2019.
Right.
And once I read that closely, then it was like the missing link from all the stuff I'd been doing on my YouTube channel.
Right.
Where I kept seeing these weird things in the Fed data versus the, you know, public, the private banking data. And it's like, why are there such strong correlations? The answer for the strong correlations between the public and private money supplies is contained in that BlackRock report.
Yes. And I added in the links the report they did to the European Union in October, where they discussed the political challenges. And what I said to you last week, and I'll say it again, because I really want everybody to kind of really grok this. These guys went in the room and basically dropped a financial nuclear bomb on the world. They made a decision to start a war. And now I'm calling it the central bank's insurrection. This is the real insurrection. And, you know, they knew Putin said in his speech at Davos, they put 500 million people out of work. They knew what they were doing. This was a clear and conscious decision.
Yes. And Putin blames it on what he called the Washington consensus. and says, it basically says, this has been going on, this Washington consensus, since the early 2000s.
Well, I would say it's been going on since they created the World Trade Organization in 1994.
Okay, but there's agreement in any event. Well, for a major world leader to come out, for the only realistic rival to the U.S. or one of the two rivals to come out and use that language and call out multiple times in that speech, United States, and say, the people in this room know that what I'm saying is true. I found just astonishing.
So I haven't had a chance to talk to you since you watched the Putin speech. And I was so astonished by it that I put it up in Daily Salieri because I thought it was very important. So I would love to know, what did you think of it?
His level of candor is refreshing, because we don't get that from our leaders in the West, number one. And number two, he's seriously concerned and is basically saying, if I'm reading the tea leaves correctly, he's saying the United States right now is not much different in terms of its geopolitical positioning than Germany was in the 30s. He's saying, you've got all the things here. You're looking for domestic enemies. You keep searching for domestic enemies, and eventually you're going to look for foreign enemies. And that's the problem.
Right. Right. Well, he's lived through 4 years of Russian bashing, and now we're into China bashing.
Yeah.
So, but I think he's concerned that there's a possibility of a nuclear war.
I think he made that pretty clear yesterday when I watched the tape. Without coming out and just saying that. I mean, you know, again, the leaders don't talk like that, but he was very direct.
My favorite comment on Putin's speech, though, was the one you made, which is, I guess he didn't get Schwab's notes.
That wasn't me.
It wasn't me. Somebody said, I guess he didn't get the notes that Klaus Schwab, sent him to for his speech. So whatever the World Economic Forum had proposed he address, I'm not sure they were expecting what he came up with. Anyway, so let's dive in a little bit and talk about what you prepared for today, starting with the Going Direct reset.
Well, the really what we'll cover today, I think, is a continuation of it. It just shows that the Going Direct reset is going on. It's very real, and it's gaining momentum.
Yes.
That's what we'll cover today, is the momentum gain. Like, these guys are serious about implementing BlackRock's Going Direct plan, and basically to short circuit it, the first half of the Going Direct plan is to get public money into private hands. And we covered that in a wrap up in depth. And then the other big piece of it is that we're going to have this merger of fiscal policy, which is typically Congress. It's always Congress to do that, to decide how to allocate resources. We're going to merge fiscal policy with monetary policy. Monetary policy being, once Congress decides on a fiscal course of action, then it's up to the Fed as the monetary plumber to implement that plan of action. And the Going Direct plan says, no, we're going to merge these functions. So basically, the Fed's going to do everything.
Right. And I think one of the most important points you made is that this is a very unique fusion we're watching going on globally between the central banks and the treasury function country by country. And more importantly, if you look at the central banks, they're privately owned. So we're watching a group of relatively invisible private central bank owners controlling the budget and financial mechanisms of countries globally.
Right. And that's the next part of the plan. And it's going into effect very clearly in the early days of the Biden administration.
Right. And another thing I want to point out, within the wrap up in the Going Direct section on the web presentation, we stacked up all your videos with your introduction and description of what's in the video. And one of the things you've gone over in your videos and you've gone over in our discussions is that during the financial crisis, a precedent under law was either established or affirmed that basically said, this is my words, I'll ask you for yours, the private owners of the central banks who are doing this are free from, they have legal immunity. They are free from the rule of law.
Yes. Well, there is no rule of law.
Right.
So
this is the legal description of the financial code. So if you look at all the different things we've seen to assert and steal money, control of government money globally since the mid-90s, you know, what we're talking about is the legal framework where private owners of private central banks control not just the central bank, but the treasury function, and they are free, you know, they are free from any prosecution or enforcement under the law.
Right. They have the best of both worlds. They control everything, but they answer to nothing if they're criminally immune, and we know they are criminally immune. I'll tell you, I recently bought a book by a Columbia law professor named John Coffey. It's another book on why the DOJ hasn't prosecuted corporate criminals. An earlier a book on the same topic exactly was by Pulitzer Prize winner Jesse Eisinger. His book was called The Chicken Shit Club. I've read both of the books. They're both worthless because they don't, no, they are. They're just garbage. Just throw them in a trash can. The central question, the thing you have to answer is this. Lanny Brewer, the head of the criminal division, comes out under Obama and under Eric Holder and says, you know, Martin Smith asked him point blank. He says, when it came to Wall Street, there were no subpoenas. There were no document reviews. There were no wiretaps.
Right.
What's going on? And Brewer didn't deny it. And then Smith follows up and says, in fact, what we're told is that there was no case even close to bringing Wall Street to trial for crimes of financial fraud. And Brewer conceded that.
Did I ever tell you my Enron Cayman Island story? It was flipping back and forth during the Enron scandal that they had 700 subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands. And the head of the Cayman Islands gave a press conference, I think it was the finance minister, and said, we'd be delighted to cooperate with the Department of Justice, but as of yet, we've gotten no requests or subpoenas.
Yeah. But my point in this is that it's openly admitted.
Right.
By the head of the criminal division, that Wall Street is not being investigated. Not that there's no process. They're not being investigated. And in fact, I did an entire documentary called The Veneer of Justice in the Kingdom of Crime, where I follow that up and I say, actually, if you pin this down, what you can find is that the reason they're not being investigated is that's part of the collateral consequences doctrine.
Right.
And that collateral consequences is still in the U.S. Attorney's Manual. It wasn't taken out by Obama. It wasn't taken out by Trump.
Right.
So these people are completely criminally immune, which would include, of course, the owners of the 12 private Federal Reserve banks.
Right.
So this is
a formula for destruction of the economy or total centralization.
Yes. It's total takeover.
Right.
Yeah. Total takeover with no transparency.
Right.
Right. And it's going into effect right now. It's happening under Biden.
Well, but I think it started in September when they went into the repo market. So.
Yes, that's really part one function of getting public money into private hands. Part two is now.
Right.
Part two is going on right now with the appointment of so many BlackRock people in the Biden administration.
So let's talk about the BlackRock people in the Biden administration, because it's, you know, when I lived in a world, and in fact, I had dealings with BlackRock when I was in Washington. So for BlackRock or a private company to be involved in the way that BlackRock is with the Fed is an astonishing conflict of interest. I mean, it would never have been done 20 years ago.
Right. You
know, to someone like me, it's very shocking, especially given the, you know, the role that BlackRock plays in the public markets and in the asset management world. But now we not only see BlackRock basically designing the reset, implementing many parts of the programs for the Fed, but now they're sending all their people into the Biden administration.
Right.
Right. Or
they're certainly in key positions, key economic and financial positions. Yeah. So let's take a look at the three that have showed up so far. So the first is a guy named Michael Pyle. I'm going to do a screen share here. So this guy is Michael Pyle. He's a BlackRock guy. And he's actually going to be the chief economist for Kamala Harris, which is interesting that this is the one guy who's not really going to Biden. And what I want to do is look at what this guy, just sort of briefly look at his background and what I find interesting about it. If you go down to, if you see this paragraph, this subheading, more from David Dayen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He was an unpaid advisor to the Clinton campaign on financial policy and seemed destined for a spot, blah, blah, blah. But he was, look who he worked for under the Obama administration. It's the second line, the right side. He served as senior advisor to Undersecretary of the Treasury for International Affairs, Lael Brainard.
Who's now right? with the Fed.
Right. And right. So that... Lael Brainard is a name that you and I both know because she is up to her knees in central bank digital currency.
Right.
Okay. And elsewhere in that biography of Michael Pyle, you see that he was at BlackRock. He was in charge of something called sustainable investment, which means investing in green projects and whatnot. And that's going to be a plank of this takeover of fiscal policy by the private hands.
Right.
Is they're going to invent all these different sort of hobgoblins that are going to be used to justify vectoring public money into private hands.
Right.
Right.
And so, into private hands, which are free to expropriate private property.
Right.
It's my prediction.
And so Michael Pyle is, he's wearing two hats. He's a central bank digital currency guy, and he's the green development guy. So he gets the program here. Let's use all these friendly, we're helping the environment. We're here to help you. Sustainable development. You know, we're all about diversity and inclusion, and we need to take some of your money to help those worthy causes, yes. Which you didn't vote on, by the way.
So if Yellen moves forward, so we had a little trial balloon with Yellen saying she, you know, she was interested in looking at taxation on unrealized gains. And the reason that's so relevant is taxation on unrealized gains could force significant sales of farmland and real estate across the United States.
Right. That was so she came out actually before she was appointed and said, yeah, taxing unrealized gains, no problem. Sounds like a good plan.
Right.
And then you sent me that article. I can't remember. It was from a blog post or something about
on the farmland issue,
how it's going to wipe out a lot of farmers and force them in the position of having to sell major tracts of land.
Or so get major life insurance policies.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right.
So the first guy is Michael Pyle. The next guy I want to talk about is, what's this guy's name? He is Brian Deese, and he is going to head up the National Economic Council. And so let me do a share screen again on him and go to okay, there we go. Here is Deese, okay? And notice these guys are young too, right?
Right.
BlackRock executive Brian Deese could get major White House position. And if you look at Deese, he's another guy. If you look at, at the third paragraph down here. So not this one, not by this cabinet watch, this one, Deese here. This is the one I want to look at. And then look at the last sentence in that paragraph. He also did a turn as deputy and acting director for the Office of Management Budget and a senior advisor to Obama on climate policy.
Right.
So that should tell you there that these guys are serious about implementing this going direct thing, and they're serious about taking over fiscal policy. And this Green Deal is going to become a bigger and bigger and bigger deal, as is inclusion and diversity and all these other topics.
Right. Now, it was many iterations ago, but one of the funniest things I've ever seen is Naomi Wolf's presentation on the first proposal for the Green New Deal.
Yeah.
You know, because basically it was allowing a group of private developers to just steamroll over all laws.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm serious about this expropriation of private property thing. And, you know, Naomi Wolf prides herself on being a progressive, and she just kept losing her temper saying, this is completely lawless.
Yeah.
You know, this is the sheriff of Nottingham. So right. Here it comes. Yeah.
Yeah, here it comes. And it's coming from BlackRock. The same people who put together this going direct plan. I mean, none of this is accidental. The third guy I want to look at, I want to preface this with, this guy is Wally Ademo or Ademo. I'm not sure how to pronounce the name, but I want to look first though. Let me get this up. Just because he's not yet. Here, do you see that?
Yeah.
Okay, so Ademo is not yet in office, but that's only because of the screen you're looking at now, which is, this is the Treasury Department. Here's a list of officials and the positions. And if you look at the right column, you can see there's a ton of vacancies. And I pulled this last night, so that was February 2nd. This vacancies in the Treasury Department is, that's current as of February 2nd. And look how many vacancies there are. There's a ton of vacancies. So obviously Yellen is in place and a few other officials, but by and large, those positions haven't been filled yet. And so that's the case with this guy, Wally Ademo. But I'm telling you right now, this is the guy to keep your eye on. And I'm going to show you, I'm going to explain why. He's going to be deputy Treasury Secretary.
Okay.
Okay, so what does that mean? That's an important position.
That means he's going to oversee all the domestic finance and the debt and the primary dealers and the depository. You know, he's going to oversee the guts of the cash flows.
Okay. Let me ask you this. I had a friend as a boxer, and he had a career in Vegas. And after he retired from boxing, his name was Johnny Lira. He's dead now. He was lightweight, and he got a job in casinos afterwards. And he was an assistant pit boss. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, assistant pit boss is the highest ranking guy who throws punches. He says, right. The pit boss doesn't throw punches. He's a manager. The assistant pit boss is the highest ranking, you know, leg breaker, basically. So when I think of deputy guys, I always think that's the highest ranking guy who's monkeying in the plumbing. Is that right?
Yes, but you need to add something to that, because a lot of the money laundering and covert options is done through the councils, to the attorney-client privilege. So at Treasury, you want to look at the deputy, but you also want to look at the general counsel.
Ah, okay.
Because White House counsel, deep state to White House counsel flows out under the deputies. And sometimes you'll see attorneys parked into deputy positions, or you'll see a deputy like that guy have another assistant deputy who's an attorney. And that's so the attorney-client privilege game can work.
Okay, so this guy, this next guy, Wally Ademo, he's Liberian or Nigerian, I think Nigerian. He's a guy to watch, and I want to show you why here. Let me go back to my screen, go over to 3. Okay, so this article is not about him, but if we look down at the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. So you see this paragraph, this starting Brian Deese, do you see that?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so the second sentence, and Wally Ademo, who worked at BlackRock for just over 2 years, including as an interim chief of staff to so Larry his job, Fink.
His job is to transfer Fink's instructions either to the bureaucracy or to Yellen.
Correct.
Right.
And he's very good at that. When I saw that name, Wally Ademo, I'm like, I've seen that name before. Where have I seen that name? A guy, because it's a guy from Africa or of African, you know, he's the African named Wally. You remember stuff like that. Like, right. You know, it's like a Japanese guy named Mike, who I've come across too. It's like I don't remember that guy. And so I go look, searching my hard drives, and sure enough, I'd done this documentary called, this was All the Plenary's Men, about HSBC and how they got a complete pass on admitted money laundering, right? There was no dispute. They admitted, yes, we broke money laundering laws. And I was like, I remember this name, Ademo. So I looked at it. Sure enough, he was the guy, he was the OFAC, yeah. Office of Foreign Asset Control.
Yeah,
he was routing. He was a very, he was a spearheading the organizational efforts to funnel information from OFAC up to the DOJ so that it, where the DOJ wouldn't do anything with it and would just spike it and ignore the information. Anyway, he was centrally involved on the Treasury part of HSBC's exoneration, Wally Adamo was. And he was a young guy. Okay, I think even now, he's not even 40 years old.
So this is one of the reasons I was so furious when, you know, QAnon kept saying that Trump had taken over the central bank.
No.
Because I said, no, the central bank just took over the Treasury.
Yeah, that's
you know, exactly. Are you crazy? It's the opposite.
That's the other way around.
Yeah.
There, so, and the people who floated that theory, they never had a shred of evidence. And I would tell, I said, listen, if you've got evidence you can point to where, you know, that's actually going on, I'll look at it. But I have, so far, I haven't seen a scintilla of evidence, and I have yet to see any to this day. There is none. The evidence the other way around is they've got criminal immunity, and they got money, and they're calling the shots, and they've been calling the shots at the private hands in the public sphere for a very long time.
So let me give you an example of how bad it was. Remember, you know, the story came out, supposedly published in January 2020, but Skidmore and I had never seen it, that there was now $35 trillion in undocumented adjustments last year. Anyway, so Skidmore, who I'll record next week, has been trying to run down what the truth of that is by talking to GAO and DOD. And the GAO report says $35 trillion of undocumentable adjustments is all accounting. There's no fraud. And to back that up, they say that there is no supporting documentation for 96% of the transactions.
What? That's your conclusion from 96% of the information is missing?
So
there's no fraud?
No documentation on 96% of the transactions, but right. You know there's no fraud by...
So what they're saying is the burden of proof is on you, and right. You can't prove it because we've withheld the information.
Right.
That's what they're saying.
Right.
That's a great legal case, if I understand it correctly. And I do.
Yeah.
One other appointment, not an appointment, I want to look at real quick, just because I thought the language is really interesting. It was used here. This is not the Treasury, but this is the Fed. And in particular, it is our good buddy. Guess who? Guess who? Do you see him?
Slither.
Yeah, it's Neil.
It's Neil. Buddy.
It's Neil. It's Bald Neil, Mr. Clean. He says he's the president of the Minneapolis Fed. I think a lot of your subscribers know he's the guy the Fed trots out when they want to announce a new policy, float a trial balloon. They sort of perceive Neil as, you know, I guess a younger guy who might be able to soft soap it to the younger crowd. Anyway, I thought the language here was really interesting. We need to put the pedal to the metal to boost the economy. So in other words, going direct is still very much on.
Right.
And keep in mind, he does not mean Main Street. Most of those programs have been turned off by now.
Right.
Right. They got shut down. Right. So when he says, yeah.
KKR, Carlyle, you know, and their friends.
He means buy more treasuries, buy more mortgage-backed securities, and go through third parties so that the money gets in private hands. And we can continue to pump up the stock market. But the language that really interested me was down in the, look at the first line in the second paragraph. This is a quote from Kashgari. Right now, I'm not concerned about the high level spending. This is like wartime spending.
Yep, I totally agree. This is war. They declared war.
Yep. And he says it right there. He, you know, so that's right. I mean, if you look at the massive spikes in public debt, you know, it's war. It's always war, right? That's what the Fed's, it's a war engine. Central banks are a war engine.
But they're turning on the money at the same time that they're declaring all small businesses have to shut down, or almost all small businesses have to shut down.
That's the war.
Right.
So in a way, Putin has it backwards. It's not, they're looking for domestic enemies and eventually going to find their foreign one. It's like they figured out they can no longer defeat foreign enemies. And so now the chickens have come home roost in the U.S.
Well, it was very interesting when Putin, he said, if I remember correctly, he said there were 500 million people unemployed.
He did, but he also turned, he said, and it's true, 250 million have gotten their jobs back.
Right.
But it's still a quarter of a billion people is a lot of people to
right.
to have unemployed in a short period of time.
And what I have to tell you is when those guys voted on the BlackRock plan, they knew.
Of course.
They knew. They knew yeah. they were putting that many people out of work. So.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in your presentation on Going Direct, one of the things I put in the link in the commentary was the link to Larry Fink's letter to CEO about how we have to think long-term and be more responsible.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a beautiful thing to read in connection with the realization that BlackRock produced a plan to put 250 million people out of work.
Yeah. Do you have that letter?
Yeah. It's linked in the commentary at Solari. If you go to the Going Direct commentary that's on the homepage.
Oh, I thought you wanted to read it now.
If I read it now, I might lose my temper.
Yeah, okay. You're just telling subscribers that's something to take a look
at. That's up, and you definitely want to read it. We published it in the ESG in the ESG wrap up because I was so appalled at the hypocrisy of it.
Yeah, Fink's fingerprints are all over this Biden administration.
Well, here's the other thing. If Wally's going in as the deputy position, one of the interesting things about that, if I read his resume right, and I'm only reading it from the article you showed, he didn't have the background or the credentials for that position.
They don't. Neither does Michael Pyle.
Right. So he's simply an order taker. Are you there?
Yes.
Yeah. So he's simply an order taker. He's not going to run the deputy. He's not. If you look at the scope of work of the deputy position, you need somebody who really knows how to run it. So whoever's going to run it, it's not him.
Right. These guys are just managers. They remind me of.
I think they're order takers. They just get told what to do and they deliver the instructions.
Exactly. And that's what Adamo did. That's in all those emails in the Treasury. He was just a router. He's just a traffic manager.
Right.
And that's what these guys are. They're traffic managers.
Right.
They remind me of senior associates in a big law firm. You know, they do a good job of kind of managing traffic, getting tasks done, parceling tasks out, and implementing the orders from on high.
Well, there's also something else. If you look at guys like this, and we used them on Wall Street, and in the Bush administration, it was the same. They don't know enough about what's going on.
Bingo.
Appalled by what they're doing.
Right.
They're a little bit oblivious because they really don't know. They're gliders and they glide through and they have no idea what they're really doing. They have no idea of the consequences of what they're doing.
They're senior enough to know how to manage traffic.
Right.
But they're junior enough to still be in awe of the great Larry Fink and never question one of the great Larry's orders.
I used to call a lot of them in the Bush administration attack poodles. Because I would have these incredible run-ins with them. And of course, they were like these nippy dogs.
Yeah, exactly.
Trying to herd me into doing this or that. And I understood the consequences of what they were ordering to do, and I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And they regularly ordered me to break the law.
But if you looked at the picture of Michael Pyle, and you saw the picture of Michael Deese, they're about the same age.
Mm-hmm.
Wally is the same age as those guys. They're 39, or he is 39. They're all around the same age. They don't know enough.
Right.
And the article about Michael Pyle comes out and says he's not an economist at all.
Right.
So you tell me how a guy who's not an economist at all can be Kamala Harris's chief economist.
Because he can deliver the instructions without friction of understanding the consequences of what he's saying.
Right. Yeah. They're perfect myrmidons. They're just going to execute instructions ruthlessly and, you know, go have cocktails that night.
I don't know if you've ever watched that Sir James Goldsmith interview with Charlie Rose, but at one point they bring in Laura Tyson, who's the National Economic Advisor, and she's just spouting the official line. And Goldsmith is looking at her like he's trying to be polite, but it's really hard to control his temper because he's basically saying, you know, this is a death killer. You're going to kill millions of people and destroy millions of businesses. And, you know, you don't even have a clue what's going on. He just really had a hard time holding his temper. But that's, you know, she's like a more elevated These guys are going to be more gliders and, you know, and more charming than Laura, but it's the same thing. They have no idea of the consequences of what they're doing.
No, they don't. They don't. And, but they're going to do whatever BlackRock wants them to do, whatever the senior guys at BlackRock tells them to do, they're going to do it.
So I'll tell you a funny story. I just published a short biography, a short book review on Salieri of George Friedman's latest book. And normally I read Friedman's books, but I don't do a book review. I don't recommend them. But this one, I had to say something because what Friedman said, and this is my words, not his, this is my interpretation. He said, we're going to have a wave of technocrats that are going to drive America crazy. And then by the end of the decade, we're going to throw them out. And then it's going to be morning in America again. Huh. And I'll tell you what my interpretation was of that. We're going to have technocrats drive all the prices down to nothing so me and my friends can pick up everything cheap. And then once we own and control everything, we're going to boot them out.
And yeah, let then it, what?
Well, then we'll bring in tons of immigrants and let things grow and it'll be morning in America.
Wow.
That's my read of it. Now,
that's horrifying, you know?
Well, but here's the shocking thing to me, John. And I think this is what is so hard for most people to understand, is we have a wave of people who are engaging in the American version of the rape of Russia, and they think it's fine. Right. They have no empathy with all the businesses they're destroying. You know, if you look at the Democratic Victory Party, they were like, wow, it was great, it worked.
It's more than a lack of empathy. It gets to what, you know, one of the things that was interesting in that Putin speech was that he says, you know, I talk to business owners who are in the productive economy. And he makes it very clear that I'm listening to what they're saying. And the Washington consensus, it's not that they lack empathy. They're actively hostile toward that segment of the economy.
Well, it's the parasitic versus the production.
Right.
And Putin has traditionally spoken on behalf of the productive.
And he was doing that in that Davos speech.
Right. So this is a, you know, the Trump election in 2016 and Putin's speech, that's the productivity backlash.
Right.
And so the parasite is getting more and more aggressive and the productive are getting more and more angry. And that's...
And Putin, that's what that speech is about. He's warning about that very divide.
Right.
In fact, he calls it one of the three central challenges is to figure out what to do about that. You know?
So the Russian statement that's very, Farrell and I use it a lot of times, Lavrov a couple of years ago said, the Americans are not agreement capable, meaning they can't make and hold an agreement. And part of what Putin's frustration was that. But I'm seeing it globally. And it's a, you know, we make a mistake of thinking this is America or Russia. This is globally the productive class versus globally the parasitic class. And it's very tied into monetary and what the productive class are beginning to realize, thanks in no small part to work like yours, is the parasitic class has just gotten a hold of the government treasuries.
Yes.
And that's a devastating move on the chessboard.
And that's a good segue. I want to go back to this Yellen, Yellen story about the unrealized gains, because I think there's kind of a lesson here, which I'm going to do a share screen and go to the story. Where are you? Okay, you can see that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at this, so this is the third bullet point. This is a CNBC story about Howard Marks and all. But if you look at the third bullet point down here in the story, Janet Yellen, Biden's nominee for Treasury Secretary, said she would consider taxing such unrealized gains to boost government revenues, reported Reuters. And what's interesting to me about that is that that's when she's obviously only the nominee at that point.
Right.
And so it looks to me like the deal was, if you come out, okay, it's not enough. You've told us this privately, that you'll consider the unrealized gains as fair game for taxation, but we need you to say that publicly. Right. So we can stick you to it. And if you do that, yeah, you're in. You're in as Treasury Secretary, right? Because they could have bounced her for any number of reasons,
right?
Right. Just her financial disclosures alone, just the Senate contributions
right.
of 800. They could have said, "No, this is too much. we need somebody who's a little more detached. But they got her on the hook for those unrealized gains. And then what happens once they do that? Well, I'm going to do a share screen again. And you go and you see this.
They want the farmland. Bill Gates wants that farmland.
This is a whole, the Lonesome Lands. I don't know. I've never seen this blog. It was something, an article you sent to me. I read it. America's family-owned farms now face the greatest threat to their existence. And to be clear, the greatest threat is taxation of unrealized gains.
Right.
Because, exactly. You know, it's a tough business to make a buck in. And if you could tax unrealized gains, it means farms that have been in the family for centuries. Suddenly, you know, the unrealized gains of those, that's the entire value of the farm.
Right.
Right?
So they either find a way to roll these up into corporations, you know, really convert the business model, or get big life insurance policies if they can afford it, or they got to sell.
But that's a move, clearly a move on private property from the powers that be through the Treasury Secretary.
Right.
Right? Absolutely. You get her to endorse it. Oh, if mom says it's okay.
Well, you know, it's not only farmland. It's going to be in the big cities where they want to reposition things. Mm-hmm. It's going to be forcing. And, you know, I told you about that report of property tax assessments going up. So they have all these little machinations to unstick real estate from the current hands.
Yeah. Right. And I think that is, we're going to see that go on more and more and more. And Yellen also, remember the famous thing from 2017 where we're not going to see a crisis in our lifetimes.
Well, we're not.
Right.
From our point of view, this is nothing but a glorious roll-up.
Right. Right. So anyway, that's sort of the continuation that's going on in the Biden administration from the going direct, you know, it's in the first days. I mean, Wally he's not even in position yet.
Right.
And you can see what's going on. BlackRock has got a very major position in the executive branch.
So the most poignant question I got on the going direct reset is, could we do a 2-5 page summary? So I've asked one of my team to write a 1-page summary, which I'll circulate to you. So I wanted to see if I could get it into 1 page.
Yeah. I could do it.
Yeah.
Two or three pager. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot there, you know, but there's a lot of moving parts, because unless you understand, you've got to have that monetary background on there's the two circuits.
Right.
But if you're not aware of the split circuit monetary system, that the commercial banks are creating our money and the central banks are creating reserves and they don't mix. If you don't understand that BlackRock statement about getting public money into private, that's whoop. You're never going to catch it.
I don't see why it's hard to understand, in the sense that, you know, we talked about this last week. This is not a downturn. This is a takedown.
It's a turn down.
Right. So the central banks turned the economy down. This is a controlled implosion.
Yes. So
I was having a squabble with somebody yesterday. They were saying it was a collapse. This is not a collapse.
No.
You know, this is a takedown. It's just, you know, this is not some natural event. And to me, that's a pretty simple concept. You know, that's a one sentence concept. You don't need even a whole page to say it.
Right.
So the central bankers got in the room, agreed to do this. They knew what they're doing. They're competent. They knew what the ramification would be. And then they proceeded into the market in September to do it, and out it's rolled. And at some point they needed the air cover to implement the different regulatory things they wanted to do. And that was a healthcare crisis.
Yeah.
To me, this is simple. And I think the reason people struggle with it is, how do you help people fathom that it's that?
Well, to me, I'll tell you what, the most aha moment in doing the wrap up was just sort of poking around, looking at graphs. The one graph that summarizes it for me is the University of Michigan consumer sentiment graph. Because what you see in that graph is, you literally see the divorce of the real economy from what Putin called, what did he call it? He called it the virtual economy. Right. I thought that was interesting language on Putin's part too. Right. Like we always call it like the productive economy and the financial economy.
Right.
Putin called it the virtual economy.
Right.
That's like, wow. He leaves no doubt about which side he's on. Like your virtual economy is fake.
Yeah.
It's all fictitious asset valuations.
Right.
That's your economy? Are right. you kidding me? Anyway, in that University of Michigan consumer sentiment, you see the real economy, that the consumer sentiment is a leading indicator. That once you start losing consumer sentiment, it's a matter of time before the recession hits.
Right.
But suddenly this year or last year, the consumers, it's a lagging.
Right.
It's a lagging. So in other words, the policymakers got out ahead and they bum rushed everybody. They bushwhacked us.
So I have to tell you who the BlackRock guys going into the Biden administration remind me of. They remind me of Macron. Remember the
yes.
story when he went out on the streets and all the people in the streets, the yellow jackets, who are trying to talk to him about the economy. They have this look as it's slowly dawning on them that he has no clue how the economy works.
Yeah.
And if you look at all those, you know, order takers, they have no clue how the productive, they've never had to sell it for more than it costs you to make it. They have no idea.
No, right, right. Right. They've gone to law school. They think they're there because they're brilliant.
Right.
And I'm sure
they have very high IQs.
Yeah.
You know, but I always said I'd rather have somebody from Hickory Valley who had to sell it for more than it cost them to make it their whole life than 150 IQ from Silicon Valley, because they don't know.
You know, yesterday when we talked, I kind of confessed a grudging respect for Mariner Eccles.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I look at his testimony from the 40s. He's the chairman
of
the Federal Reserve. His name is on the Federal Reserve building. But Eccles, he didn't graduate from high school.
Really?
Yeah. Never graduated from high school.
You know, some of the best educated people I know never graduated from high school or college.
But he was a major business owner out in Utah. I'll tell you why Eccles was where he was back then. That guy understood the monetary pipes better than anybody. I mean, off the top of his head, his testimony, presumably, now I don't have a video, obviously, they didn't have video.
He had to figure it out bottom up.
Holy cow, that guy understood what the score was.
Yeah.
I mean, the notion that somebody like, you know, Tim Geithner or Ben Bernanke is going to get up there and testify like that, or Powell or anybody, it's just laughable. They don't understand that. But Eccles is a real guy. In other words, Eccles' roots are in the productive economy.
Right.
And that era has come and gone, and it's been gone for a while.
I had no idea. Yeah. I did not know that about Eccles. Yeah. That's fascinating.
I fell out of my chair like, wow. Because I was asking, I was like, how does this guy know so much? I was like, that's how. He owned businesses in Utah. Yeah. I mean, like real world businesses. He understood how things worked.
So do you have time for me to go to a little bit about China and Russia?
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, Russia and China have been trying to build a system. We just did a fabulous interview with the French author of An American Trap. He was a guy who'd been prosecuted under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It's a fascinating interview.
Prosecuted in the U.S.?
Yes. Yeah, wow. It's one of those horrible Department of Justice stories.
Oh, God.
Another one that we did an interview is Howard Root, cardiac arrest. I don't know if you've seen that.
No.
But it's these, you know, these horrible Department of Justice sort of control of the economy things. Anyway, but he was talking about why to get away from the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. You know, literally the Chinese and Russians had to be able to transact and never come through the dollar system and never use English and never use the U.S. law. And, you know, you had, because the DOJ now asserts if you transacted with dollars, they assert jurisdiction.
Wow. So that's all it takes, huh?
Yeah. So he's talking about what the Russians and Chinese are doing to build a separate system. And right after Putin gave that speech, it was reaffirmed that Sberbank, the largest Russian bank, is coming out with their stable coin.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they're moving forward. And Sberbank, I don't know if you remember, the president of Sberbank is a very impressive guy. His family was originally from Germany. And he gave an incredible interview last October talking about the fact that the world order was going to come unraveled. It's I quoted it extensively. It was in TASS, and it's worth looking at. He's an amazing guy. And but we also saw this week American and Chinese jet fighters in Taiwan airspace. You know, some people say playing a dance, other people say it was a real hot war.
Right.
Now, for jet fighters to be competing, you know, one of my fears was the Democrats traded Taiwan away to get the White House. But I think you think that's where that isn't happening. But I see real tensions in the South China Sea with China and Russia trying to move away.
Yeah, I want to, I've got the Putin speech here.
Okay.
And I want to, and I've got, it's too long to play the whole thing, but I want to, and I'll have to separately send the audio track for this, but I want to play a segment. Just listen to the language he's using. And it shouldn't, let me look at my notes here, see how long this clip is going.
And one of the reasons this is noteworthy is because Putin has been very good at holding his temper and keeping his temper and speaking calmly and coherently. I've never seen him this angry or agitated ever.
Okay, I'm going to do a share screen. It's going to be a little awkward, but at least we'll be able to see Putin. And what we're listening to be clear, is not Putin. It's his translator, his interpreter. His interpreter. Do you see? Can you see that?
Yeah.
Do you see him? Okay. Yeah. I'm going to blow that up, even though it's going to look really bad.
Fuzzy.
But that's okay. But hopefully you can hear it. Oh, I've got a, you can't hear that, right?
No.
Right. Because
if you send us the audio, we can play it.
I know, but what I'm going to do is unplug my headphones. So it's coming out of my speakers.
Okay.
Just so you can hear it in real time. Okay. But I want you to just listen to Putin's language so you can hear it now.
Such imbalances in global social and economic developments are the direct results of the targeted policy that has been conducted since the ages of the last century, often blatantly and dogmatically, based on the so-called Washington consensus, with its unwritten rules that give priority to private debt-driven economic growth, with deregulation and low taxes on the rich and corporations.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
Great thing about this is, you know, so we've been talking about how inequality is engineered by this central bank treasury function, and it's intentional.
Right.
And he's basically affirming that.
Right. That's exactly right. And the other thing is he's blaming private debt mechanisms.
Right.
Which is the very thing in the BlackRock plan. Get the public money into private hands. And of course, in a debt-based monetary system, getting money into private hands means private debt.
Right.
That's what he's complaining about.
Right.
And you're right. He does. You know, I'd said he complains about the Washington consensus back to the early 2000s. At the beginning of that clip, I just caught it. Listening to it a second time, he says going back to the mid 1980s of the previous century. So he's much more.
I didn't notice that one. Wow.
Yeah. That's, I just caught that. Anyway, you see it. So his timing is exactly the same as yours. I thought there was a difference. I don't know how I got the idea it was early 2000, but he just said, no, it goes back to the mid 1980s of the previous century, at least if it's translated.
Well, you know that, now, are you saying 1880s or 1980s?
No, previous century, meaning the 20th century.
So the 1980s is when the Iran-Contra fraud exploded.
Right.
And then it went into the 1990s fraud. They create the WTO, the financial coup starts.
Right.
But he's right. It started, you know, when it started, exactly. It started when the Voyager passed Saturn. That is exactly when it started. And that's when the mortgage fraud started. And it's amazing to go through and unpack the early mortgage fraud. You get the impression that they just said to the guys at ONI and the CIA, just get money. Just get as much money as you can. Just get whatever money you can. And off it went. And my impression is they just kept saying, wow, we got away with it. Okay, let's double down. We got away with it. Let's double down. You know, and then they add to the stock market and derivatives, and there you go.
You know, one of the things I mentioned, the boxer Johnny Lira earlier, I'll tell you another Lira story. It's kind of crazy. He's come up twice in the same Money and Market show. He, you know, after his boxing career ended in about 84 or 85, he became a pit boss, assistant pit boss. But he worked a lot of private jobs in the Las Vegas desert on security detail. And he said, I have all these jobs where there was whole planes of $100 bills flying out. I was like, what? He said, yeah, that's actually what got us together, as I was bitching about the story of the Chiasso, Italy, and the $134.5 billion found in the suitcases. And he heard we were in a bar, and he heard me talking about that. And he said, I've got some stories for you that you might be interested in. And he started telling me about the planes, I mean, big transport planes.
So I always believed that Las Vegas was set up to launder the money for Area 51.
Yeah.
So, but my favorite one was Daniel Hopsicker, when he was working on the Barry Seal story. He called me and he said, Barry Seal's flight logs, he'd take the gun, you know, he'd take the stuff down, come back with the money, and then he would stop off before going back to MENA at Area 51. Why would Barry Seal stop at Area 51? I said, Daniel, he was dropping off the cash.
Yeah, well, yeah, anyway, I totally believe what he, because the timing of everything he was saying, it matched up, because he was talking about middle to later 80s through the early 90s, and it matched up perfectly with all the stories about the coming out of the Southeast LA.
So let me explain what the reset is. If you started then and you did more financial fraud and more financial fraud and more financial fraud, you come into the financial crisis, you know, you steal more, you clean up some financial fraud, but it's still just growing. The question is, at what point do you have to just wipe out and start afresh because you can't pile up any more financial fraud?
Right.
Really?
Right.
So, you know, and if you look at their decision to suck all the money they've sucked out of the federal government, you know, all those liabilities are coming due. That's why I think they want to break up the country if they can. I mean, that's part of what this insurrection is about. Because if you can get the states to pull out, then you can blame the inability to, you know, you've taken the assets, but the liabilities are still there. Social Security, right. Healthcare, military pensions. And so if the people insurrect, then you can blame them for destroying Social Security. Well, it's not our fault. You wanted to secede. So
right.
You
know. Right. It's always the blame game, and it's always the cover story. Like we don't blame the shutdowns and the lockdowns on the problems in the economy. We blame this virus.
Right.
It's like, that's a complete cop out. Right. Exactly. No virus ever went in and shut down a business. That's a crock.
Well, here's the thing. If you don't have this cover story, somebody's going to turn around and say, wait a minute, we want the $21 trillion back.
Right.
And right. The legal mechanisms are there to get it.
The other thing behind, you know, there's so much fraud, you have to kind of hit the big reset button, is interest rates. You know, interest rates are low, and Putin talks about that too, the low interest rates fueling this, you know, the virtual economy and the financialization. But, if you think about interest rates, I mean, we're paying a lot of money on interest on the debt right now. With interest rates next to zero, what happens if they spike up to 5%? It's ball game.
If you go to digital currencies, then you can do negative interest rates.
Right, you can do whatever you want if you've got total control like that, right? But right now, I mean, if you increase I don't know the answer to this question, but the question is, what would the interest rate have to be for the United States to be formally bankrupt? And for the formally bankrupt definition being, When you can't afford the interest payments on your debt, it's over, right?
So it's a hyperinflation question, because remember, you're printing.
Right.
Your debt is denominated in something you can print.
Right.
And so the question is, you know, it's not a bankruptcy story; it's an inflation story.
Right. Well, it is a bankruptcy story in that your money should not be, you shouldn't be borrowing your money. That's ridiculous. And it's going to lead to problems when the break point is when your debt payments, you can no longer make your debt payments just on the interest.
The break point is when the average person realizes
Why do we need these guys in the middle? We can do it without them.
Right. Right. Well, I think, I don't know. That's going to take a massive amount of education, you know, but we'll see what happens. Then I want to, let's kind of wind it up on a sort of a humorous note. I've got a clip here, and you don't even need to see it, but I can put it up on my screen. Your subscribers can see it, about the GameStop kerfuffle. Uh-huh. And so what amuses me so much about this episode is how upset the power structure is, the powers that be are, that these gamers are doing this to hedge funds. They're so upset that these guys are just the cartoon they have in their heads of dudes in their basement driving up this stock and inflicting pain on these wonderful hedge fund managers is more than the financial powers that be can bear. So the clip I'm going to play you is from MSNBC, I think. Is it? Yes, it's MSNBC, and it's an interview of a guy named Professor Scott Galloway. He's a professor of marketing at NYU. Oh, this is
unbelievable.
The Bloomberg host is Stephanie Ruhle. She's very reliable when it comes to, you know, bowing down and kowtowing to the Wall Street gods. And then the third panelist, you can't hear him or maybe not be able to see him, is Andrew Ross Sorkin. So you know, just from the content, you kind of get the sense of what this is going to be about. But I want to play this clip because it's this Professor Galloway reacting to these kids in their basements. And it's just the most hilarious thing I saw in the whole GameStop thing. So I want to play it. All right. Can everybody see the screen?
I can see it.
Okay. So here we go. Oh, I got to unplug my headphones so we can hear it. The audio is going to be a little rough, but I can send you a better audio when we're done. Here we go.
That I would ask every young man to decide, maybe you're learning here, maybe it's fun, fine, maybe it's a movement, but be prepared to lose 80 to 90% of it. And if it's still worth it, then have at it. But the biggest loss of capital here will be the human capital of young men who are sitting and staring at their phone and watching the price of Bitcoin or the price of AMC. And ask yourself, would you be better off taking that 1, 2, or 3 hours a day and working out, trying to form relationships with mentors, with romantic relationships, with people at work, getting great at something so you can be the person on the other side of the trade? The greatest loss in capital here is from young men who are more prone to gambling addiction, who don't understand the markets. I think we are setting ourselves up similar to how there's a ton of young women out there who became very depressed by sitting in their rooms looking at Instagram, self-cutting and self-harm skyrocket. I think you are going to see an explosion in young male depression, and I think a lot of it is going to be reverse engineered to apps that convince you you're part of a movement or physically addict you to your phone. Ask yourself, would your time staring at Robinhood be better spent somewhere else? That is the real capital destruction that is taking place here.
So is that great? He just wants to help.
So here's my read of what he said. If you join the parasitic economy, we have nothing to harvest. We need you to go back and be productive.
Yeah.
Right. So we can't harvest you. If there's nobody who's productive and everybody's a parasite, then it won't work.
Right. But but my main argument is I'm trying to help you.
Of course. We're here to help you, John.
And somebody took Galloway up on Twitter and said, hey man, listen, us guys in our basement, we are getting laid. The difference between us and the hedge fund guys is we do it with people consensually.
So one thing I do want to bring up, because the best coverage on the GameStop story was at Wall Street Parade.
Yeah.
You know, the reality is if you look at who traded this up, it was the dark pools. It was Goldman, UBS.
Right.
You know, and there's a much deeper, more complex story of what's going on here.
Right.
And that's why I'm very curious to see how they use this.
Right. It's an interesting story, but again, the powers that be, a certain segment of them, have been whipped into a lather, as you just saw. That presentation by Galloway was utterly ridiculous.
It was ridiculous. The one I loved, because Jim Cramer has been remarkably honest. You know, he was the one who said this is the biggest wealth transfer in the history of
right.
Western civilization. He, for the first day, he disappeared. He didn't do his show and he didn't tweet. It's like something, you better shut up Cramer because, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, another guy who's sort of been candid, a highly promoted guy, Tony Robbins, has been very candid, not about GameStop, but about the pandemic and how it's just all a scam. It's just you're counting flus as COVIDs, and they're not.
So I think that something very interesting is going on, which is, you know, we've now got to the point where young people can connect the dots quickly.
Yes.
And the information, the learning speed on our team is going up dramatically. And part of the reason is because we have very significant members of the establishment who are leaving their team and saying, you know something, we'd rather be out here in the wilderness with everyone else. You know, we don't want to be a part of this.
Right. I find it much easier to talk to nieces and nephews, you know, particularly ones in their teen years, and tell them what the real score, they want to know what the real deal is with the economy, than I do friends of mine who are 50 years old.
Right.
They're just like, oh, no, it's just, you know. If it's not on TV, it's not true. You know.
Well, I'm.
Kids know it's not true.
Wherever we are, I'm very grateful to be out here with you. Anything else you want to cover today?
That was really it. That was the I couldn't let the Galloway thing go. It was just too. I mean, you got to talk about leading with your chin, man. I had to finish off with that one.
Well, but how come they think they can get away with this? I mean, I think he doesn't know.
The hubris is unbelievable.
Right.
It's if there's no, it's like the 39-year-olds. They just, they don't know.
They don't know. They really, really,
you know, don't know. Stephanie Ruhle and Scott Galloway and Sorkin, they think they're there because they're great. It's right. Like, no, you're there because you served the interests of the people who put you there. And as soon as you stop, do you know where you're going? Out the door. I'll throw you out on your ass at 30 Rock. Uh-huh. Right? For sure.
Right.
Try it.
Okay. Well, John Titus, thank you for joining us on Money and Markets. We'll be talking to you in 2 weeks.
Yeah, good to talk to you, Catherine.
Have a great day.
Bye.
If you haven't listen to the discussion that I did with John last week on the Going Direct reset, it is a must watch presentation. And if you can, please read the web presentation on the Going Direct reset at the 2020 annual wrap up. You can just click to the web presentation from the commentary. The link is right below the video and right below the video and audios. And this is what is driving everything that's going on our world right now. And what John is saying about essentially the private owners of the central banks taking a much more direct control of the government is very important to understand. And we're watching it everywhere. You see governments all over the world that are very much in flux. So the heads of state have resigned, or the cabinets have resigned, or the legislature is waiting for an election. And literally the governments are not there, and you really have titular heads. And if you look at the dependency and the high debt loads, the sovereign government debt loads, they're basically at the mercy of the central bankers. And you're seeing this all across Europe. We're seeing resignations. We just saw the Governor General of Canada resign. The Netherlands government has basically, the cabinet has resigned, and basically the prime minister is now sort of a fiduciary until the elections in March. And the lockdown has just been rolled over now until March. We see Mario Draghi, the former head of the ECB, going in to run the Italian government. Very, very scary. Also, a paper that I put into the News Trends and Stories by Robert Rubin and Stiglitz, basically proposing a new framework for fiscal mechanisms, and I would describe it as the central banks sort of engineering their hydraulic pump into the fiscal mechanism. Pretty scary. What you're watching is there's a tremendous gap between running a global secret empire by force and all the democratic governance structures and republics throughout the world. And essentially, the people running the global secret empire have just decided to, you know, take control. And again, it's been done by a financial coup, and now we're watching the ultimate consolidation in the legal structures. You know, this coup, the financial coup, I've been writing and talking about since the creation of the WTO in 1995. And that's when all the really crazy business started going in the United States with, you know, sending drugs into neighborhoods and then sending SWAT teams to round up innocent kids and throw them in prison. You know, when Hitler did it, you know, they called it slave labor camps or worse. Anyway, there's a very interesting article that was published this week that I also recommend by journalist Lee Smith, and it's called The 30 Tyrants. It's about the role of oligarchs and China and how much damage two powers getting together and one power using another foreign power to destroy its own and attack its own population. Money and markets. All returns are, remember, for 2021 year to date, so just for the first month and a few days. It's the Wednesday close. The US dollar is now up about 1.4% for the year, so it's off the floor. It got down to 90, and of course, the question was it going to break that 90 technical line? And, you know, if it had broken down, we'd be in a whole nother world, but it's bounced a little bit back and it's clearly coming off the low. We've seen a couple of things happen this week that basically make you really wonder how the strength of the treasury market is going to hold. One, we saw a Chinese and U.S. fighters over Taiwan in Taiwan airspace. And the question, you know, some people just said it was a dance. Other people said there was a real dogfight. I have no idea what it was, but it's, you know, the whole rise of China is beginning to seriously encroach. And for Chinese planes and U.S. planes to be dancing at a minimum in Taiwanese airspace is extremely uncomfortable. We saw an unbelievably strange thing with a White House press secretary poo-pooing the Space Force and then getting a huge backlash from the Republicans. And it made you wonder why a White House press secretary would not understand how power works on the planet and give a signal that the U.S. intended to be weak in space. Very strange. Fixed income market, the treasury market is off 5%, right in line with laughing at the Space Force and dancing around with Chinese jets in Taiwan airspace. The intermediate treasury is down 1.46%, bond aggregate down almost a point, and junk up 32 basis points. Of course, people still looking for yield. Equities, the S&P is up 2.13%, home builders up 7%. VGK, the European ETF, up 1.56, the Germany up 2.14, the developed markets minus North America up 1.66, China flying at 11%, and it's going to be very interesting. That's one of the reasons that Lee Smith's article on the 30 tyrants is so interesting. Emerging markets up 7.88%. Now, of course, some of this reflects the soft dollar. Commodities up 6.7%. I saw one piece, I think it was in Kiplinger, let me see if I can find it, the other day that indicated that agricultural commodity prices were up something like 28% over the last, I can't remember if it's 6 months or a year, but, you know, just I keep saying, grow your own food, get that local fresh food, find sources of food because food's going up. Gold now down 3.65% for the year, silver 1.47%. I just think that's noise. I continue to think that gold and silver are in a long-term bull. depending on the which oil index, we've got one up at 14.29%, another at 44%. GM has now set a 2035 target to phase out gas and diesel-powered vehicles globally. Wow. Okay. So what's that about? I think that's much more about going to centralized control through the smart grid than it is about energy. And given all the demands of energy by running digital currency systems or digital financial transaction systems, particularly with blockchain, I still want to know where all the energy is going to come from. It's going to be interesting. In the U.S., let's talk about the U.S. The U.S. is in a very dark place, and it's getting darker. And the question is, how dark will it get? The war on populism has gone to a whole new level. Unfortunately, the strategy of destroying the independent producers so that you could win the election was successful, and the people who did it, it's almost like a shark that smells the blood in the water. So there was an effort to fake a quote-unquote insurrection on January 6th that was totally faked. There was no insurrection other than, you know, the faked part. A couple of activists were, from what I can tell, were set up and framed. And part of this is proposing an impeachment and a domestic terrorism law. We're seeing all sorts of announcements from DHS, DOD, and various places in Washington. You know, it's almost as though everybody's trying to please the guys upstairs by coming up with more ways of using domestic terrorism laws and concepts to attack the population. And this really is a war on the general population. There's no doubt about it. So we had a fake insurrection on January 6th. They claim five people died. Clearly one person was shot by the Capitol Police. And the question is, what's the real story in the others? I don't know. But I never saw an insurrection. I saw sort of a staged event. So the impeachment with Trump, it appears, is probably going forward. And I think that's all along with having the National Security Guard in Washington, all designed to make it look like there's a real insurrection. Because, of course, you want to get the domestic terrorism law, and you want to use that law, among other things, to scarf up as much real estate as you can. Again, this is a war on independent producers and small business. I talked a lot with John about using the tax system to also unstick a lot of real estate and drive the price of real estate down. Because remember, if you've got this kind of, if you've got $400 trillion trying to get into real assets, that's going to be a lot of pressure. And anything you can do to drive the price down by, you know, doing it in a way that hurts your enemies is how you're going to manage your war. A lot of what you're watching is projective identification. So if you're guilty of a financial coup and you've stolen $50 trillion, then you want to attack the people you stole it from before they come ask for their money back. We saw Jeff Bezos move to executive chairman of Amazon just in the same week the DOD announced that their military clouds could connect to the Amazon cloud. And my guess is if you look at Amazon's role in everything that's going on, particularly with the smart grid and the injection fraud, I think Jeff Bezos is probably smart enough to try and start putting layers between him and his assets because the liabilities of what he's up to are absolutely horrible. I said several activists I thought were set up at the January 6th rally. One of them was Dr. Simone Gold, and we've put up links for her crowdfund. Several people, thank you, posted them in subscriber input. And I wish she had read Deep State Tactics. So given the kind of purges that are going on, I strongly recommend our annual wrap-up last year, which was Deep State Tactics 101. It's a 12-part series in 7 recordings. So it's very long, they're transcripts. And We're going to bring out a hard copy sometime in the first or second quarter. So, but it's all available on the website. And I strongly recommend, if you don't understand the kind of behavior that comes with the purges that are underway in the United States, it might help you. One of the big stories this week was GameStop. We saw the stock of GameStop run up tremendously, and the public spin on that was that it was a group of individuals and retail investors on Reddit who had basically busted the hedge funds. The best coverage on it was from Wall Street on Parade, Russ and Pam Martins, and you know, it's pretty clear it wasn't some kind of David versus Goliath. It was the dark pools that contributed to trading it up. And Whitney Webb did a good job on her podcast of talking about it. It was a little disturbing to watch everybody sort of pay attention to the GameStop story as opposed to sort of grokking and transmitting the John Titus going direct reset. It's almost as though, you know, the big reality is a little bit too overwhelming. So it's more entertaining to look at the GameStop story. But I assure you it was a distraction. I think what was going on was the central bankers were making an example of one or two hedge funds and reminding all the other hedge funds who was boss. We saw Leon Black, the head of Apollo, step down because of an audit, sort of a look at his operation. He had paid $158 million to Epstein, and everybody admitted, oh, you know, it was just a fee for services. Right. You just can't make this stuff up. And we're really watching an out-of-control impunity. So, you know, it looks to me like Epstein was paid for inside information. Speaking of unfair prosecutions, Ross Ulbricht, the Ulbricht effort had hoped very much to get a pardon before Trump stepped down. The Department of Justice was very adamantly opposed to any kind of pardon for Ulbricht and presumably Snowden and Assange. And so, of course, the bad guys got their pardons, but not the good guys. It's going to be a very interesting story if the truth ever comes out why the Department of Justice is opposed to Ross Ulbricht getting a pardon. And it's a story I'd love to dive into deeply sometime on the Saleri Report. If you don't know about the story of Ross Ulbricht, I just do a search. His mom has a great website up, but it's an example of how much the U.S. enforcement has turned into the Sheriff of Nottingham. Good news in Europe. The European Parliament has voted down injection mandates. I suspect that may be the result of some horrible feedback on the COVID-19 injections that are happening all around the world, particularly in the elderly and nursing homes. It's really, really scary what's going on. If you haven't watched Putin's speech at Davos, you know, the Davos guys met, Putin spoke eloquently on behalf of the productivity backlash. That's what I call the populist rising. I just think it's the independent producers and the productive tired of being sort of free-ridden by a parasitic financial system. Anyway, Putin's speech at Davos was pretty interesting. I put it up in Daily Saleri, or Saleri in the News now is what we're calling it on the homepage, but the video is on the homepage at the bottom. If you haven't watched it, it's highly recommended. One subscriber was really funny and said, well, he clearly decided to throw out Klaus Schwab's talking points. So whatever Schwab told him to talk about, he talked about the real deal instead. I've never seen Putin that aggravated. And I understand completely. That's how, I used to feel when I worked in the Bush administration and dealt with some of these guys who are not, as Farrell and I keep bringing up, are not agreement capable. They don't keep their word. They don't keep their contracts. And they just make a mess. They just make a mess. Interestingly enough, as you're watching, Putin realized that Sberbank, the largest Russian bank, is bringing out a stable coin in March. So they are absolutely proceeding. China's economy, turning to Asia, is clearly very strong. If you look at the stocks, the ETFs that did the best in 2020 and have done the best since the going direct reset, it's clearly Asia that's the winner, and Israel. China moved, it was announced in 2020, to the number one target for foreign investment. And I'll just tell you my intuition on that. I don't think that money is going into China. I think it's going through China and then heading out to a variety of places. But it's the destination is China, the Silk Road, and even places in Europe. The China trade continues to rebalance, but there's no doubt that a Biden administration will be much more pro-China, much more open to China, and that's part of what Lee Smith is addressing in this wonderful piece, The 30 Tyrants. Our blast from the past tonight is the legal series, U.S. Monetary and Fiscal Operations. For those of you who are not familiar with the series we did on the missing money, we included a series of articles that I had two of our attorneys prepare, seven articles in all, about the U.S. fiscal and monetary operations, but the legal framework. So if you don't understand, money is simply a man-made construct. It's a function of law. And so it's imperative to understand the law. It's like you can't understand the body without understanding the skeleton. So it's imperative to understand the law of how these operations are supposed to work. And that was designed to make it easy. It includes a wonderful piece on FASB 56. And obviously, I keep talking and bringing up FASB 56. And so if you want to read that piece, it's in the series. But if you've ever wanted to know what the Federal Reserve was and how it works, here's your chance. I also put a link in the Blast from the Past section to the recent Blast from the Past. They're the commentaries that come up a lot in my conversation with subscribers who have, particularly in Ask Questions, oh, you should go read, you know, Turtling, or you should go read, you know, The Tapeworm, or, so it's the ones that come up the most in conversation, and those are the ones we tend to put in Blast from the Past, so I think you might enjoy trolling through that link. And let's go to the movies. Pete Kennedy recommended a short video of John Moody describing the 2011 raid on his Whole Life Food Buyers Club in Kentucky. It was on Memorial Day weekend. And, when you hang around with Pete Kennedy in the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, you hear a lot of great stories about the war between the people who love fresh organic food and the regulators who are trying to help consolidate the food system into big publicly traded stocks. Not that they necessarily know that's what they're doing. And of course, our interview then is with John Moody. One of the things Moody talks about with Pete is the conferences. He had a very successful conference last year, and he's organized two for this year, one in Nashville in Tennessee and the other at Joel Salatin's Polyface Farm. And so Larry's going to be a sponsor. We're going to have representatives there. And I really encourage you, because I think those are great places to meet like-minded people and find amazingly productive people. And it's so very important in this kind of environment to stay productive. Okay, that's it for this week. Next week, how to use the Solaria Report. Again, send your questions. And then the following week, we have a fantastic one. It's a video of Vanessa Bertschäfer's interview for the Via Europa series with Frederick Perucci, who is the author of An American Trap. I interviewed, I did a book review a year and a half ago. The title is The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, A Trap. And if you want to understand how the empire works through controlled financial systems, it's quite an education. A wonderful man, a wonderful interview. And I really appreciate Vanessa going and getting that one. It took a lot of work. Anyway, so until next week, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, 2021 is the one you have to start. You have to start one. You have to start a conspiracy, at least start a circle. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.